D-Mace, Vingan and Donick, 102.5 The Game. Willie Donick, Derek Mason, Adam Vingan, and David Janes here with you. Teron Davenport, ESPN NFL Nation Titans reporter, will join us in about 20 minutes as we break down the Titans draft class. But let's continue our conversation on Carnell Tate. A lot of you have a lot of thoughts. 615-737-1025. Let's go to Gil from Cali on our phone line. Gil, thank you for calling and waiting. Go ahead.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, thank you.
Yeah, I like the Carnell Tate deal because I just think that he fits into our offense. I think he'll stretch the field and then let Calvin Ridley and the other guy we got work underneath. But, I mean, we were going to pay all that money for Alex Pierce. He ain't the best receiver in the league, but he brings to his team what, you know, he brings an element to his team. And I just think that's what we're going to get with Carnell Tate, and I think it'll work out. They'll bring him along, and he'll get to learn from Ridley, and we'll be all right.
Thank you, Gil. One texter, Sam in Nashville, says, a lot of non-ball knowers on Carnell Tate calling in. Dude has an elite skill set and route running skills, contested catch rate, etc. Seventh best rating against man-to-man coverage in the last 5 years in college football. This player is a need for a team who was worst in the league in passing 15-plus yards downfield last year. He's an Ohio State receiver. His floor is very high. Of course he wasn't number one receiver at Ohio State. Jeremiah Smith exists. So let's get to my number crunching here. I took a lot of, this was a lot of fun. You know, I love to get nerdy on spreadsheets and stuff.
Yeah, so, just specify. It's fun for you.
Oh,
yes.
I'm sorry. It's not fun for everybody. It's fun for me.
Sometimes
okay?
It's fun for me. Not all the time, but it's sometimes.
I had some fun.
Every once in a while.
So here's what I did. I looked at, well, it's a good thing I'm here and I find it fun and it helps all of you.
Right.
Here's
you do the math so we don't have to.
That's
like
fair.
It.
That's fair. Okay. So here's what I did. I looked at top 10 drafted wide receivers in their rookie seasons since 2021. There were 10, and I said, hey, that's a good number, 10. Then I realized one of them was Travis Hunter. So I took Travis Hunter out of the mix. So there are 9. Here are the receivers who were drafted in the top 10 since 2021. Tet McMillan, Malik Nabers, Marvin Harrison, Rome Odunze, Garrett Wilson, Drake London, Jamar Chase, Jalen Waddle, and Devontae Smith. Pretty good collection of wide receivers, wouldn't you say?
Very good.
Yes.
So here's what I did. I looked at all of their numbers from their rookie seasons per 17 games, added them all up, found an average. So their average, again, 9 top 10 drafted wide receivers in their rookie season since 2021. I'll read the list again. McMillan, Nabers, Harrison, Odunze, Wilson, London, Chase, Waddle, and Smith. Their average per 17 games, 80 catches, 1,046.2 yards. You can round that up to 1,050 if you'd like, and 6.5 touchdowns. Let me read those numbers again. 80 receptions, 1,046.2 yards, 6.5 touchdowns. That was the average of those 9 receivers. So, Willie, you make a great point in the first hour. I did not look at all of the quarterbacks who were throwing these receivers the ball. You do have to take that into account. You're absolutely right. But if you're just looking solely at the statistical output, the average, 80 receptions, roughly 1,050 receiving yards, and we'll round up to 7 touchdowns. Is that doable for Malik Nabers? Not Malik Nabers, for Carnell Tate in year one?
I'm not sure that it will work. And the reason is because there are a lot of variables. This is what concerns me. Mm-hmm. First of all, you went out and you spent a pretty good amount of money on Wandale Robinson. That's going to be a lot of, unless you're just using him as a decoy, which I don't think they will. He's experienced. He knows Dable's offense. Mm-hmm. He's going to be an important part of the offense. That's going to be around 100 targets right there. Then there's all the other guys that were there last year. There's Ridley. There's the two guys that were rookies last year. We know that. There's Gunnar Helm. I think they want to run the ball. They seem to have the most success. Cam Ward had the most success when he was supported by a good running game. So I don't think they're going to flip it around 40, 50 times a game. So all that to say, I don't know that he could get those numbers unless he gets a huge amount of yards per catch, like catches a lot of deep balls.
Which he does.
That's the scenario averaged, where I could see him get close to 1,000 yards. But I don't think the 80 receptions is going to be in there.
He averaged 17.2 2 yards per reception last season, so he does catch the deep ball. So that could happen again. The average. Top 10 drafted wide receivers in their rookie seasons since 2021. 9 receivers. McMillan, Neighbors, Harrison, Adunze Wilson, London, Chase Waddle, Smith. Per 17 games average, 80 receptions will round up to 1,050 yards, will round up to 7 touchdowns. Well, like, for example, let's look at them individually. Tet McMillan last season in Carolina. 70 receptions for 1,014 yards and 7 touchdowns. Marvin Harrison in his rookie season, 62 receptions, 885 yards, 8 touchdowns. Rome Odunze, 54 receptions, 734 yards, 3 touchdowns. That, I think, would be a disappointment. But, like...
But I think that is much more realistic.
Like, I'm looking at Harrison.
For the first year.
I'm looking at Harrison, Derek, in his rookie season. Fellow Buckeye, Marvin Harrison. 62 receptions, 885 yards, 8 touchdowns. Would Titans fans take that exact stat line for Carnell Tate? And I believe they were drafted both number 4 overall, if I'm not mistaken. Would Titans fans take that exact stat line for Carnell Tate and call it a successful rookie year?
Would Titans fans do it? Probably not. They would probably look at it as, oh, we could have got that guy later on in the draft. Do you mean in the first round, I mean, not later on in the draft. But there are some that may say, well, we could have got him in the second round. But again, they're not looking at, you know, the totality of it. They're not looking at, you know, a young quarterback still developing. You have other guys, you know, how is Daboll going to run his offense to start off? You brought up a good point. Them bringing in Wandale Robinson. They didn't just bring him in just to be a guy. He's going to be featured in this offense at least early on. Why? Because he's the one guy that knows this offense in and out. And the best throw is the shortest throw. This guy gets open very quickly in short spaces, which gives Cam an opportunity to release the ball very early. Okay, so he doesn't have to deal with offensive line problems, if indeed the Titans have those type of problems this year. But so you got to look at that. Wandale, how does Wandale Robinson fit in this? You understand, he has a sort of, he's probably 10 yards in front of everybody. Why? Because he's coming from an offense that he knew. He knew this offense. So now he's coming into it. So he's going to be ahead of everybody. So eventually, it's all going to work out. Tate's going to be the number one. I think that this is one thing that I understood, especially watching Ohio State over the last 2 years. People watched in Ohio State because of Jeremiah Smith. They zeroed in on Jeremiah Smith. But you know who just kept popping out the screen for me? Carnell Tate. Every time this kid just popped out of the screen, it was like, damn, if he went somewhere else, he would definitely be the featured guy. There would be no hesitation. Why? Because that's what I want to see. If I go see this five-star guy, and mind you, Carnell Tate is a four or five-star guy, but this guy popped out just as much as the five-star that everybody's raving over. Again, he's not Jeremiah Smith, but when I damn watch that film, it's like I can't see a difference because both of these guys are making plays that I never could make.
I also look at he's 21. He's going to be a young rookie.
21 the whole season, mind you.
Yes, he's a young 21. He'll be 21 the whole season before he turns 22. So I think that it's going to be very difficult to ratchet up to be the number one the very first year. That's why I always say it's not about how well he does the first year. It's how well does he do over the first 4 years, 5 years, as the roster, in theory, gets better. I don't think he has to light it up the first year to necessarily be on track to be the, quote, number one. He could grow into it, and I think the support of Wandale Robinson and, in theory, Calvin Ridley and the other guys that played with Cam Ward last year, the Gunnar Helms, the guys who are starting as sophomores, basically, that should help him carve out his role over time. So I don't think you have to put in there, hey, he's got to be the number one from day one because he's the fourth pick in the draft. That's bad thinking. And so if he is an efficient, like this is the other thing. If he gets 55 catches for 800-something yards, whatever you use one of the guys.
Harrison, 62 receptions, 885 yards, 8 touchdowns.
Yeah. also, it's like, when do those catches happen? Does it happen at the end of a game where you're getting blown out? Mm-hmm. You know, that happened a couple times with Calvin Ridley the first year.
That's an average of about 14.3 yards per reception, by the way.
I'll give you an example. They played two years ago when Levis was the quarterback. It was kind of late in the season. They played the Chargers. They got way behind. It was like 24-0 or something. And then Calvin Ridley ended up with two touchdowns at the end of the game. His numbers looked good. And we were like, hey, Will Levis' numbers looked all right there. But in the context of the game, it really wasn't that big of a deal because it came when the game was already over. So it's when you make the catches is a big part of it too. I could see if he had 500 yards, but the team was making big progress and he made key catches at key times. This is what I thought Corey Davis eventually ended up being. He wasn't a superstar, but Corey Davis on that team that went to the AFC title game, and then the following year, he made key catches at key times and was a great balance with A.J. Brown and with Derrick Henry. He was part of a very efficient offense. To me, that is just as important as how many yards did you get, how many touchdowns did you get.
Totally. I totally understand that. But you know,
oh, yeah.
a lot
well,
of people
trying to put it out there
are
now.
Going to base it on the numbers.
Yeah.
By the way,
but what if Wandell Robinson catches 100 passes and has 1,200 yards? There's not going to be another 1,000-yard receiver on the team. If he's doing that well, or if they're running the ball well, or if Calvin Ridley has a resurgence, there's all kinds of things that can affect those numbers.
One texter says, matching Tet McMillan output would be a win. McMillan last season, 70 receptions, 1,014 yards, 7 touchdowns. By the way, there are some outliers on here. Jamar Chase in his rookie season, 81 receptions, 1,455 yards, 13 touchdowns. Absolutely insane by Jamar Chase. But again, the average of per 17 games of McMillan, Neighbors, Harrison, Odunze, Wilson, London, Chase, Waddle, and Smith, top 10 drafted wide receivers in their rookie season since 2021. Their averages, 80 receptions, 1,046.2 yards, 6.5 touchdowns. Also something I find interesting. Mm-hmm. Something else that Carnell Tate is going to be judged against. Three of the past five offensive rookie of the years have been wide receivers. McMillan, Wilson, and Chase. At the moment, DraftKings Sportsbook, offensive rookie of the year odds, Jeremiah Love is the favorite, plus 200, followed by Fernando Mendoza at plus 400, Tate and Jordan Tyson tied at plus 500. But three of the past five offensive rookie of the year winners in the NFL have been wide receivers.
And I get it. There's a precedent that is being set. You know, you come in and you know, as a wide receiver, and if you go to the right spot, you're drafted high, you got to come in and produce. And, you know, not to say that every receiver that comes in drafted that high needs to be offensive player of the year, you know, but it looks nice. To the fans, if you indeed have the offensive player of the year that you drafted fourth overall. All of these guys that we named off, they're all wearing different situations. Like Tet, there was no – he got target. One, he was playing with – he's playing with a quarterback that's still developing.
Bryce Young.
That whole team is sort of developing. They got themselves in the playoffs, which is a, you know, a good thing. They're headed down the right track. But that whole team sort of was developing together. He had 122 targets. You know what the next closest guy target-wise was?
I'm going to guess. Somewhere in the 60s?
Yeah.
What is it?
Yeah. 64.
Okay, who was
then
that?
Then the next, that was Xavier Leggett, the wide receiver. And he's young, too.
Yes, he is.
Then the next guy after that was Rico Dowell, the running back, with 50. So he benefited from not having other guys around him that can sort of help him sort of usher into that number one wide receiver role. He didn't have nobody else, so he had to be the guy. And even being the guy, his numbers are good, but if you drafted him at number four, I'm not sure, based on what people seen Chase and these Neighbors do, they would look at that and say, oh, he needs more. Which I think, based upon the situation he was in, this was really good for a first-round pick with nobody else around him, basically, at the wide receiver position. Tate comes in a different situation. he has other guys that have been in this league that have produced. And my hope for him is this. One is that the Titans are winning, first and foremost, because I think regardless of how many numbers he's put up, it's about winning a ball game. So hopefully the Titans are winning. And if the Titans are winning, then that means they're not relying so heavy on Tate that, you know, that the other guys are sort of being left out. When you're winning at a high clip, that means everybody's involved.
One texter, Jason, wants to know what Malik Nabers' numbers were. I don't think he appeared in every game in his rookie year. Per 17 games, Malik Nabers, 123.5 receptions, 1,364.5 yards, and 7.9 touchdowns. So there was Malik Nabers.
But Malik Nabers, they haven't won a lot of games.
Nope.
One texter says, I'm not too concerned with the quantity of catches by Tate, but the quality of catches.
Right.
If the quarterback can rely on him on third downs and in the red zone, that's what I'm going to look at. And one texter says, Tate has a better quarterback in Cam Ward versus Bryce Young in Carolina with Ted McMillan. 615-73. You could argue with that. 615-737-1025. Teron Davenport, ESPN NFL Nation Titans reporter, will join us coming up next. We'll get his breakdown of the Titans draft class. We'll ask him these questions about Carnell Tate as well. 615-737-1025. All of our offseason coverage here of the local professional football team is brought to you by Tennessee Brew Works. Finely tuned craft beer for finely tuned fans. Tennessee Brew Works, official craft beer of the offseason coverage here on 1025 The Game. D-Mace, Vingan and Donick, 1025 The Game, by the way. Titans rookie minicamp Friday and Saturday at Vanderbilt Health Football Center. That's a weird thing to say. How long have we been saying St. Thomas Sports Park? It's now Vanderbilt Health Football Center. Man. But rookie minicamp Friday, which is May 1st, geez, and Saturday, May 2nd. One man who's going to be out there, our next guest, Teron Davenport, ESPN NFL Nation Titans reporter, who is presented to us by Bart Durham Injury Law. Hi, TD. How are you?
Hey, what's going on? How you guys doing?
We're doing well. I know you've had a busy weekend covering the NFL draft, so let's start there. Give us your assessment of the Titans 2026 draft class, what you liked, maybe what you didn't like, any other remaining questions after the draft? Go for it.
Yeah, well, I like what they did at pick number 60. I think that was the best value pick, getting Anthony Hill Jr. there and getting a guy that's going to come in and start at middle linebacker. That's probably my favorite pick, but I don't know. I think they could have came out with another defensive back. This was one of the first drafts in a long time where they didn't select a defensive back, so that's intriguing. But it looks like Marcus Harris is going to be the guy at nickel. So overall, I think it's a solid draft. They did a good job getting guys that will compete. I think Nick Singleton is a good pick as well. I like what Mike Borgonzi said when he felt he reminded him of Isaiah Pacheco. So I thought that was a good note there. So overall, I think they did a solid job. But as you know, these things, you got to wait until, you know, a year or two down the line to really see what the impact was.
That's why, Teron, I always get a chuckle when people grade draft classes the day after the draft, because it's a fool's errand, I think, to project what a draft class is going to be immediately after it comes together. But at the top of that draft class, of course, number 4 overall, wide receiver Carnell Tate from Ohio State. We've been spending the first half of the show discussing expectations for Carnell Tate. We've talked about statistical expectations. We played a clip from Malik Nabers. He said on the Thursday of the draft that he wasn't sure Carnell Tate is a wide receiver number 1 in the NFL. Let me ask you this, because you're level-headed. Let me rephrase that question. What would constitute a successful rookie year for you for Carnell Tate?
Well, first off, let me say this. As much as Malik Nabers, as much as his game is exciting and fun to watch, he wouldn't have been a number one at Ohio State last year either. So let's just, you know, call a spade. Jeremiah Smith is one of the best receiver prospects to come out in 10, 15 years. So it's okay that Carnell Tate wasn't number one there. But I will say this, the polish, the route nuance, the ability to win at the top of the route and those things, it's all there with him. And then on top of that, D-Mace, you could attest to it from watching him. He catches with his hands. There's no body catching or anything like that. And I really love the way his hands, you know, the positioning and everything he has when he's catching the deep pass. Like, he's going up to get it. And it's natural and it looks good. So I think, you know, when you look at this player, it's hard to put numbers on it because who knows how this offense is going to work, right? Because, you know, Wandell Robinson has to get his targets. So it's going to be tough to really put a number on it. But I would say, you know, 6 to 8 touchdowns, that's where I think he really has to come into play, being able to put the ball in the end zone. And we know, watching him last year, you know, he had 9 touchdowns. 5 of them were 40 yards or more.
We'll talk with Teron Davenport, recapping the NFL draft, mainly the Tennessee Titans. Now, TD, do you see it as this? Because whether this young man come out, hit the ground running, or not, that's not my big thing. I just want him to develop, and I think ultimately he will be that number one. And when I say ultimately, I don't mean 2 or 3 years down the line. But I think this year, how important is it going to be for Calvin Ridley, one, to stay healthy, and then two, be that guy that Carnell Tate can sort of, you know, bounce things off or have on the field with him?
Yeah, that's going to be imperative. And I remember, you know, talking to Chris Sanders about that, and he told me how, Webster Slaughter. He said Webster Slaughter was the guy that really showed him the way. You know, look, Tate is very polished coming out, so he knows the position and understands it, but I think the benefit is going to be seeing a guy like Calvin Ridley and Aya Manor and DK. They saw it last year. They're like, man, the way this dude goes on every rep, like, who am I as a rookie to take any rep off seeing him go 100 miles an hour every time he's on the field? So I think that's really going to be the plus. And just showing him the way, you know, working through, you know, a slump or a bad season, understanding that football is a beautiful game because it will both crown you and humble you. And sometimes that can happen all within 1 week, you know, and being able to ride those highs and lows. Having a guy like Ridley that has done that, I think, will really benefit him.
Now, I'm sure there were plenty Titans fans that were, as the draft went on, especially as you started to get to the second and third and fourth round, they were wondering, like, man, when are the Titans going to draft an offensive line? Because that's been the trouble for the Titans the last 2-3 years, is not having a solidified offensive lineman. Offensive line in this league. But then they go out in the fifth round, they draft Fernando Carmona out of Arkansas, then they go get Pat Coogan out of Indiana. How do you see these guys? Do you see them as day one starters, or do you think these guys are going to have to develop and then ultimately become starters in this league?
Yeah, I think Coogan will eventually become a starter, and he's a guy that I kind of earmarked for the Titans as early as the combine. You know, I said, this is one of those guys that could probably get later, you know, on day 3, and he's so experienced. And you look at just what he brings to the table as far as the leadership and the intelligence and the communication. We know the objective was to make sure it would be easier for Cam Ward. Obviously, that was more having a veteran be able to call the protections and stuff like that, but you know, Pat Coogan has seen an awful lot at Notre Dame and Indiana. So I won't be surprised if he at some point becomes a starter. We'll see what Austin Sloatman brings. But I like the battle at right guard, right? And you look at Fernando Carmona, as you mentioned, man, that guy is nasty. You know, he has a really nasty streak. So you got that. And then you look at Jackson Slater, you know, he'll be in there as well as Cordell Volson. So they have a competition going at right guard. I like the idea of having the competition to breed success, and we'll see what it does.
Talking to Teron Davenport. Teron, what do you think the dynamics are for Falk, the edge rusher that they traded up to grab at the end of the first round? I think he's in a better spot maybe than Tate, because he's going to be under the radar. Tate's going to be getting all the attention. There's better support along the line with the pieces they made. I feel like maybe he's in a position to maybe grow into it. But tell me where you think he fits.
Yeah, it's always sweeter when you're the second of the 2 first-round picks, right? So, like you said, he'll be able to kind of bask in all the sunlight going to to Tate, but I think when you look at Ball, it's the length, man, and they're really banking on him being a guy that's going to capitalize on the coaching, and that's going to be a major thing. He said that he and Aaron Whitecotton, like they formed a nice bond during the whole process. So it's going to come down to coaching, man, and just him finding a way to have that pad level lower. He's going to have to find a way to get to the quarterback and finish, as opposed to being around him and you know, bothering him that way. You got to seal the deal. So he may end up starting right opposite Jermaine Johnson, with Femi being, you know, a rotational guy. But we know they're all going to play a whole bunch. The versatility's there too. You know, his ability to bump inside and use his quickness and length. It's a different approach than what you typically have there, you know, on the interior D-line. And Robert Saleh mentioned as such, you know, that's something that he feels is going to give him an advantage.
I was going to ask about the lack of production. So you think that's it? Because I've read that about the scouting report on Falk, that he looks like he's on the verge of big plays, but his production was down. I think only had 2 sacks last year. So there's pressures without the result of the sack. So how do you factor that in there? How do you think the Titans did when they evaluated him?
Yeah, again, like, yeah, 30 pressures, 2 sacks, like you mentioned. And, you know, that's too many contracts left unsigned. You know what I mean? Too many meals left unfinished. And you got to be able to seal that. And I think really it comes down to they believe that they could coach him up into it. And I asked him about that specifically, and because I'm like, yo, your pad level is good when you're on going against the run. Like you do that well, you don't get high, but then it gets high against the pass. And he talked about firing out of the 3-point stance and just how that whole process is. You know, when you're playing the run, you just naturally stay lower, but it's something that he's going to have to do. And this is where your Aaron Whitecottons, your Robert Saleh's, this is where they show whether or not they're worth their weight as far as positional coaches are concerned, because the guy's got talent. He's got length. He's 20 years old, so he's still got a lot of man strength to acquire too. So it looks good. There's potential, but you ask any coach and they'll tell you, you know, son, your potential could get me fired.
Right. You know, Herm Edwards used to call those 2 staff guys,
yeah.
Right? The first staff doesn't get the results, so you get the results on the second staff. They benefit. But I was going to ask you about the age, because, and I think the third pick falls into this category as well, but you mentioned it. They're both young prospects. They're getting drafted, both Falk and Tate, the earliest possible time you can get drafted, which is a good thing. It means they've grown into this window early in the context of so many college players now tend to be older. So how do you think that? Do you think that was by design? Do you think that factored in, Teron? I don't hear this talked about as much as I think it should be these days.
Yeah, I think it was more coincidence than anything. Because I mean, they drafted older guys in Coogan and Carmona. They're both older than Latham. So, you know, it kind of swung the opposite direction. So I think it just came down to these were prospects that they liked, and they felt that, you know, they were good on the field, off the field, and hey, you know what, the age, it was just an added bonus. I think that's how it works. I don't think they really targeted these guys because they're 20 years old.
I got one for you before we get out of here, TD. You mentioned Femi, and he has been sort of the lost guy in all of this. Even when, you know, they brought him in, they drafted him in the second round, it was like he was a project because he was playing a new position. How do you compare him to Keldrick Falk? Because it seems to me that Keldrick Falk is sort of a project in another sense. But these, you have two guys with it. If you're talking about the measurables and everything else, they have it. But now you have two guys that is trying to learn a position both at the same time, really.
Yeah, look, man, those are two guys where it's like, you know, if you wanted to design an edge-setting defensive end in the 4-3 scheme, you'll come out with a product similar to Falk. Mm-hmm. He's you know, his lower body is solid. He's long. He's strong. He's lean. Hey, that's what you want, you know, and he knows how to use just as I always think of you know, watching Vrabel work with those guys where it's like he's showing them how to, like, position their arms and turn the lineman inside to seal the edge. And length is always a big bonus for that. So I think that's something that he brings. And then when you look at Femi, you know, Femi is just like – remember the old He-Man dolls, man? That's what Femi looks like. You know, one of the He-Man dolls. Just the way he's built, you know. And then also just looking at him starting to learn the pass rush. I watched him work with Coach Lo Locus, who today is her birthday, by the way. But watched him work with her and with Ben Bloom, the outside linebackers coach, the pass rush coaches. And you saw him just come along as the year when he got more comfortable with his hand movement and just, you know, things to do with it.
Teron Davenport has been our guest on D-Mace, Vingan and Donicky. Joins us every Monday and is presented by Bart Durham Injury Law. TD, as always, a pleasure. We'll catch up next week.
All right, appreciate it. And oh, guess what?
What's that?
No matter what, let's go Mets.
Stay with it. Times are tough, TD. Got to hang in there. You know it's bad when the Rockies pitching staff comes into your house
and pushes you around
down for three straight games.
Man.
Yeah.
That's not good.
It's a tough life to live, but, you know, love isn't always easy.
Keep your chin up, TD. Keep that chin up. Six.
You got it.
Thin line between love and hate.
615-737-1025. We'll take your thoughts on what Teron Davenport had to say about the Titans draft class. 615-737-1025. But coming up next, I do want to sneak in a hockey thought because the Stanley Cup playoffs are ongoing, some fabulous games, and I think Willie and I are going to disagree on something. And we'll discuss that next. 615-737-1025. Willie Donick, Derek Mason, Adam Vingan, 1025 The Game. D-Mace, Vingan, and Donick, 1025 The Game. Willie Donick, Derek Mason, Adam Vingan here with you. We will get back to the NFL and the NFL draft coming up at the top of the hour. But I do want to devote a segment to the Stanley Cup playoffs because the Stanley Cup playoffs have been fabulous overall. One hell of a finish last night in Anaheim between the Ducks and the Oilers. To say the least, Willie, I can't turn off the Tampa Bay-Montreal series. That series has been fabulous from start to finish. Like, if you haven't watched any of the playoffs, I recommend it. The games have been great. Well, some of them. Not all of them have been great. Two games tonight. Philadelphia looks to eliminate Pittsburgh in Pittsburgh. That's game five of that series. Vegas in Utah as well tonight. I believe, Willie, that is also game five of that series, if I'm not mistaken. Or is that
game four?
Game four. Oh, geez. It is game four. That series started late, I feel like. Anyway.
Utah is up 2-1 and playing at home. So it's crunch time for the Golden Knights.
Indeed.
You could have a mammoth Ducks second round for a chance to
throw out the record books when the Ducks and the Mammoth come to town.
And you would have this is the issue with the draw, right? Not playing the 1-8, 2-7. You have a draw where in the West, it's very imbalanced, one bracket versus the other. And to me, there's just no comparison between the teams in the two brackets. And Utah is good. Like, and Anaheim has got to be extremely encouraged at what they're doing against the Oilers.
Up 3-1 on Edmonton.
Yeah, the Oilers, the two-time defending Western champs, have got a whole list of problems. They could be out in the first round.
Tomorrow.
Right after Connor McDavid re-upped for two more years. And as I said, the moment he did it, they're not getting better. They're getting worse.
This is the
ultimate, roster around him.
The ultimate nightmare scenario for the Edmonton Oilers would be to lose in the first round to the Ducks in five games after Connor McDavid signed that contract. But there is one series I do want to focus on, and that is a series that concluded yesterday when the Colorado Avalanche swept the LA Kings. The Avalanche won 5-1 yesterday in the final game of Anze Kopitar's soon-to-be Hall of Fame career. And this isn't going to be an argument, about whether the Predators could have done better than the Kings if the Predators had made the playoffs and drawn the Avalanche. Because quite frankly, I do think that these Kings were one of the worst teams in recent memory to make the playoffs. If not for the fact that the Kings went to overtime every night, they would have been nowhere near the playoffs. But here is what I was thinking as I watched this series and read a story from my friend Corey Massasak of the Denver Post about the LA Kings he published over the weekend. The headline of that story, by the way, if I can find it, how Kings ended up in NHL's mushy middle after Stanley Cup triumphs is a case study for other clubs. And here was my takeaway from watching the Avalanche dispatch of the Kings in four games. Whenever we have the discussions about what the Predators should do, should they keep trying to make the playoffs? Should they intentionally rebuild? A lot of you will point out that you don't want to rebuild. You want the team to try to be competitive every year and try to make the playoffs. I would submit to you as a counter-argument, the LA Kings. The LA Kings have made the playoffs five consecutive years. The LA Kings have lost in the first round of the playoffs in five consecutive years. The LA Kings have now lost eight consecutive playoff games dating to last season. LA was up 2-0 on Edmonton in the first round last year. Edmonton won four in a row to win the series. And of course, the Kings were swept by the Avalanche, so 4 + 4 = 8. Eight consecutive playoff losses. So when I hear that, hey, there's value in making the playoffs, what value has there been in the Kings making the playoffs each of the past 5 years? They haven't stood a chance, I would argue, in those 5 years. But what my ultimate concern is, and then I know Willie wants to offer his counter-argument.
Oh, you're stepping right into my trap, by the way.
Okay.
You're walking right into my counter.
This is what I would argue. The last thing that I want for the Nashville Predators is to be the LA Kings. I do not want the Predators to make the playoffs 5 years in a row with little to no shot of actually winning a series, let alone a championship. So when you say, oh, I think the Predators should try to make the playoffs, may I submit to you the 2022 through 20 or 2021 through 2025 LA Kings? I don't see the value in being first round fodder for one of the top teams in the Western Conference.
Okay. First of all, they lost four straight years to the Edmonton Oilers.
Yes.
And much better Edmonton Oilers teams than this year's Edmonton Oilers. Agreed?
Yes.
These were the best premier Oilers teams. So it's not that they just lost to five different teams. There was one team they could not get past, and it was the luck of the draw, the situation you have, the way they do the brackets, which is flawed. 85 to 90% of the fans and players and coaches do not want this system because it's not fair. It leads you this way. So I would argue they were good enough to win some rounds, and they were right in some of those series. It's not like they didn't, but they are at a crossroads now. But Adam, you're leaving out the most important thing that you are omitting.
What is that?
They did rebuild. They went through the rebuilding to get to this group. When they won cups in 2012 and 2014, in the years after that, they still were trying to win for a couple seasons. And then they reached a point where it was like, okay, this Daryl Sutter Kings team that won twice is out of the window. So they regrouped. They shut it down for a while. They amassed the number one prospect pool in the game.
In 2021, according to our friend Scott Wheeler of The Athletic. I just wanted to put that
they were the number one prospect pool that year.
Correct.
So they went through a rebuild. And so they missed the playoffs for three straight years and 4 years out of five. And it took a while to build that team back up. So they went through the very process that you've been saying that the Predators should be doing.
And now they need to do it again.
So now you think they should do it again?
Yes.
Well, they may not have a choice at some point. But this is my argument. It has been my argument all along. You can do that, but it doesn't guarantee you that you're going to win playoff series just by deciding you're going to rebuild for a few years. They appeared to go through all the steps, and they did it relatively quick. But the prospect pool is a tough thing. They did have some high first-round picks that didn't pan out. And the one crown jewel, Quentin Byfield, still could have the light go on. Would you agree? Like, he still could turn out to be a very special player. But he was the second pick in the draft. He's turning into a very good player, but not a great player. Would you agree?
Yes.
So it just shows you
he is a young player. His career high in points is 55. He's been in the league now for parts of 6 years.
But he's still only, what, 23, 24 years old?
He is 23. He'll be 24 at the start of next season.
Okay, so he's still young, and they've invested in him. They're hoping for another level. But the more time that goes by, it looks like he's, like I said, a very good player, but not the crown jewel that you're hoping for with the second overall pick. So my point is this, that all of these things are case studies, and it's another one in the bucket to me of rebuilding doesn't always work.
That is true.
Just because you rebuild doesn't mean you're going to have this star-studded lineup 5 years later, and this is a great example. That all of those guys they had in the number one prospect pool, you read the names, and now, in retrospect, you're like, these guys were the number one prospect pool? But they were so excited about it. They took their time. They took 3 years to compile it. But some of the other moves that they made since then haven't worked super well.
Yes, the Kings, to the Predators' credit, the Kings made some mistakes. Trading for Pierre-Luc Dubois, big mistake.
In retrospect, yeah.
That cost them Gabe Vilardi. Kevin Fiala has been a good player for the Kings, but to acquire him, they had to give up Brock Faber, who I think is going to win multiple Norris trophies for the Minnesota Wild.
Multiple Norris trophies?
Yes.
I don't know if he's that good, but he's really good.
He's pretty damn good for his really age. He's really good. But my point is the Predators...
But Brock Faber, at the time they traded, he was a college player. He was, I think, a second-round pick. He was not a high first-round pick. They traded for Kevin Fiala. It was a brilliant move by the Wild in retrospect, but Brock Faber was a prospect, and they also got a first-round pick, I think, for Fiala. And Kevin Fiala is another one of those guys that is a guy that you can't live with him, you can't live without him, right? Which is why the Predators traded Fiala for Mikael Granlund, right? Kevin Fiala is going to get his points, he's going to have his big moments, but he stopped short of being the great winning player, the great money player. And Faber has turned out to be a very special player, but I don't know if the Kings knew what they were giving up at that point. I don't know if anybody could have known how good Brock Faber was going to be when he was playing for, what, University of Minnesota or wherever he went to school?
That sounds right. Here's something else I want to point out, and your points are well taken. Here's something else.
But you admit, the Kings did rebuild after the 2014 season. Eventually,
yes,
they got to the point.
They did undergo a rebuild. Yes, they did undergo a rebuild.
So they did what you are saying that they should do.
And it didn't work, and they need to do it again.
Right, but this is life. Sometimes things don't work.
Hold on.
They did all the steps that you say that teams should do.
I know. Not every case is perfect. Even I acknowledge that. But here's something else.
So they sacrificed years and still didn't see the fruit.
Yes, and now they...
That's the biggest risk to me of doing a rebuild. You're going to have bad years,
mm-hmm.
and there's no guarantee that you're going to automatically see these great playoff success stories having gone through it.
Here's how quickly, and then we'll get to your phone, 615-737-1025. Here is something else that stands out to me. As you mentioned, Scott Wheeler, friend of the show. Last month, earlier this month, the months run together at this point, said that the Predators have the fifth-ranked prospect pool in the NHL in 2026. As you mentioned, in 2021, Wheeler said the LA Kings had the number one-ranked prospect pool. This, to me, is an argument that quality, to me, is more important than quantity. So we don't know how the Predators' prospect pool is going to work out, but I remember when we had Wheeler on the show, you asked him the question. And Wheeler mentioned, hey, with this group of prospects, you're going to have a high floor. But it's still missing that one player who can put them over the top. So to me, when I look at the Kings prospect pool in 2021, now that we have 5 years of hindsight, to me it looks like a deep pool that was missing that guy. Quinton Byfield has been in the NHL now. I think he's played...
You said parts of six seasons.
Parts of six seasons. I want to get the total number of games. He's played 339 games over six seasons. He's still young. He'll be 24 when next season starts. But I would venture to guess that by now, we probably know what Quinton Byfield is going to be. He's going to be a good player. I mean, again, he's had a 55-point season, a 54-point season. But does Quinton Byfield, after 6 years and more than 300 games, look like a player who's going to be the next Anze Kopitar for the LA Kings, the center that leads the team to Stanley Cup championships? I would, if I had to guess right now, I would say no.
No.
So to me, that's why when I look at the prospect pool, I look at the overall depth of the Predators pool, and that's why to me I value quality over quantity.
But they had a mix. They had at least three top 10 picks. Alex Turcotte, who was looking like a middling fourth line player. He was the fifth overall pick. They also had Brant Clark, who was super hyped up. That looks like he's going the route of Byfield. Good player, but not super cornerstone, needle mover kind of thing. So they were bad to get the high picks, and those picks have not turned out to be great. They also got the quantity. They used the quantity to try to acquire two other high-end players. Pierre-Luc Dubois, they used a bunch of guys to get Pierre-Luc Dubois. That was a total bust. And then we mentioned Fiala. Fiala's a good player. He is who he is. But they traded some of their depth and prospects to get him. So all that to say, there's no one way to do it. They did the Adam Vingan plan. They did it.
I never said.
And they ended up in the mushy middle the same way.
I never said that it's a foolproof plan. You've never said, to be fair to you, you've never said your plan is a foolproof plan. There is no such thing as a foolproof plan.
It's hard. It is hard to build a winner. You got to get a little lucky.
But when I look at the Kings losing in the first round 5 years in a row, losing eight consecutive playoff games over two seasons, to me, my first thought was, when Predators fans say, hey, I value making the playoffs, I see the Kings, and I'm like, you don't want to be the Kings? You don't want to be a team that gets into the playoffs with no shot? 615-737-1025. We've got some reaction. We'll get to it next. 615-737-1025. Willie Donick, Derek Mason, Adam Vingan, 1025 The Game.